Back at it with you on Tuesday, January 19th, 2021, right here on Connecticut Today. We heard from Scott Linsicum, our buddy at the Cato Institute, about how the government may go forward and about the Balancing Act coming up for the incoming Biden administration. We got the latest from Governor Ned Lamont regarding Connecticut's coronavirus situation and the ongoing vaccination program. And I also kicked off the show with some of my thoughts regarding the at least perceived notion that if you're a Republican in Connecticut, you really don't matter. I wanted to start with something, though, on the state level here in quasi-local. Something that I saw over the weekend, and I said to myself, well, who's surprised here? Now, you know that back a couple of months ago, the governor's executive powers were extended for the coronavirus situation here, the pandemic. This was the first extension here that was going to take him up to and through the early part of January, where we are now. And a lot of people at the time said, listen, we're still in a COVID emergency here in a pandemic. It's, you know, to do these closures and a lot of the stuff here, I'm sorry, but we have to forego or at least put aside the legislative process here because, you know, we just have to be nimble on our feet as we do this. Well, okay. And I think I told you at the time, it's not going to be just one extension. You watch. So sure enough, and this came out yesterday on Monday on the holiday, and I'm reading the story from the Connecticut Mirror. Now, the folks at the Connecticut Mirror generally do a good job. By the way, the Connecticut Mirror was started, I think, 8 or 10 years ago by a bunch of former Hartford Current writers who got cleavered during a big layoff there years and years ago. They're a nonprofit, actually, website that does some good writing. But again, the headline on this story is really another tiptoeing around the issue of reporting news straight ahead and really saying what it is. So yesterday I'm kind of poking around, you know, in between just relaxing at home, watching some hockey yesterday, doing some cleaning and everything. And I see this. I see from the Connecticut Mirror, again posted yesterday on the 18th, legislative leaders support extension of Lamont's emergency powers during COVID. I said, legislative leaders support extension of Lamont's emergency powers during COVID. Then you read the first line. Leaders of the Democratic majority of the General Assembly support the extension of Governor Ned Lamont's emergency powers past February 9th to further curb the spread of the coronavirus. So the headline, again, I would openly debate somebody, you know, who has a J degree like I do and somebody maybe from the Mirror. And again, I know they do good work. But legislative leaders? No, it's Democratic leaders. Exactly what you said in the first paragraph of the story. But to the meat of the article, leaders of the Democratic majority of the General Assembly support the extension of Governor Ned Lamont's emergency powers past February 9th. Those powers, set to expire in 3 weeks, have had wide implications during the pandemic. Lamont has used his authority to restrict who can be evicted from their homes, mandate people to wear masks, and limit the conditions under which businesses can open. Senate President Pro Tem Democrat Martin Looney of New Haven said there will be some extension. The issue is for how long. House Speaker Matt Ritter shared a similar sentiment with municipal leaders last week. But you go down 5 or 6 paragraphs in this story. Here are the meat hooks, folks, of the article. You go down about 5 or 6 leaders. Neither Lamont nor Democratic leaders have reached out to Republican leaders about the issue. Neither Lamont nor Democratic leaders have reached out to Republican leaders about the issue. Neither Lamont nor Democratic leaders have reached out to Republican leaders about the issue. Finn Candelora, State House Republican leader, saying that, quote, we're getting behind the eight ball yet again and almost making it a fait accompli that these orders will be extended until the legislature, until the Democrats are forced to do the right thing. That's from Finn Candelora. Folks, this is, you have to understand something. If you are an independent, maybe a right-leaning independent in this state, or even perish the thought, if you're a registered Republican, a conservative, or maybe a Republican voter in this state, oh my God, you want to kill children and old people. Folks, if you're anything but a Democrat in this state, you don't matter. You don't matter. You do not matter. Now, you could say, well, Paul, geez, these are extraordinary times. Okay, yes, I'll hearken back to what this says in the Connecticut Mirror. Neither Lamont nor Democratic leaders have reached out to Republican leaders about the issue. And the issues brought up here as to what Vin Candelora said. And there you go. So, you know, people say, I love people when they come up to me, or I was on some discussion board this weekend among some, you know, radio professionals. Well, you right-wing hosts, all you do is sow discontent. Really? Really? I'm sowing discontent because I point out 99 times out of 100 in a blue state, a left-leaning state where nobody in the Republican Party has any influence over anything, where all the major newspapers, except for a couple, are reflexively leftist in their editorials. I'm the problem, pointing out the fact that for most people who are Democrats in Hartford, unless you are in their party, you're just an inconvenience. You're a doorstop that I got to kick you out of the way. That's what it is. You want to convince me otherwise? Sure. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So listen, and I have credited Governor Lamont for a lot of the stuff he's done through the pandemic, some of the other stuff I'm critical of. But again, this is a perfect example of how Democrats in the General Assembly, who are elected to do a job and to voice the concerns of themselves and their constituents, it's like, well, hold on, I got a little dust on my shoulder here. Oh, yeah. Flick the, to the Democratic majority, the Republican concerns, it's like dandruff. It gets, you know, oh, geez, what is that on my shoulder? Get that out of here. February 19th, 2021. We'll put the phone calls on hold to welcome back a guy who's writing I love, Scott Lincecum. He's a senior fellow of economic studies at the Cato Institute in D.C. Cato kind of positioning itself as a libertarian kind of free market. It's not on the right like the Heritage Foundation. It's not way out on the left like the Brookings Institute. Scott, great to have you on. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me back.
You have a piece here that caught my eye. Populist indulgence thwarts serious governing. And the subtitle here is, there's a price to be paid for lying to large swaths of people so as not to disrupt their feelings. Hallelujah. Are we finally realizing, Scott, what went on here and what's going on here in the country?
Well, I'm hoping so. You know, we've unfortunately on January 6th really saw the fruits of a very long period of basically telling a segment of the voters that, you know, whatever they feel is true, and that you know, that they can simply override that reality in this case with force. You know, it's unfortunate in the sense that, you know, it's really been building for a while, like you said. Now, my focus was really on the policy side of that. And certainly that's not leading to, I don't think, you know, violent insurrection. But of course, the political side of it is really what brought us to that point.
And yeah, I mean, I keep saying, Scott, all the time, and I tell people, you know, who call this show and also I chat with on social media, I always say, Scott, you know, Donald Trump and what he is and what he said, He's not the cause of a lot of this. It's a symptom of our politics and of the divide we have in this country. And I tell people it's really easy to pound on the messenger, but when Trump is gone tomorrow and kind of fades away over the next couple of months, Scott, we're still going to have a lot of the same problems.
Right. And if you look back at the Republican primary from 2015 and 2016, you saw again and again that Trump's attachment to the facts was pretty weak, but that voters rewarded him for that. And you know, the old saying was the voters knew what he really meant, not maybe the words that he was saying. And that, I think, again, has really permeated politics on the right these days. That the simple facts, whether it's about trade and globalization or immigrants or manufacturing jobs or you name it, there are certain fundamental realities about those things that we seem to have just discarded because they either raise very complex and difficult policy questions or they raise issues that really don't have an easy and simple solution. And that, as that kind of takes over politics, as emotion drives politics, it really makes governing quite difficult because you can't actually then implement policies that will truly, address some of the real challenges we have. You start going after boogeymen, whether it's, foreigners or immigrants or whatever, instead of attacking kind of the root causes, the real causes of our problems.
Exactly. Scott, hang on right back to you. And I'm glad you ended up with that because, some of these early Biden policies I see that have been announced are just going to take us back in that same old circle. Scott, hang on. Scott Linsicum, Cato Institute's with us, back with more from Scott. First, we check traffic and weather together. 3:36, 24 before 4, right here on WICC. Scott Linsicum is the guest. You can check out all of his writings and columns at the Cato Institute. That's cato.org, cato.org, as we continue to talk about the fallout of what we've just gotten out of and what we're heading into. And Scott, it's interesting, you tailed off the last segment on the difficulty to govern. So, we get this appeal from Joe Biden, and obviously he's going to say this, we have to come together, we have unity. And I'm like, okay. And then over the weekend, Scott, I see that, they're going to pull the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. Here's an immediate plan for legalization of illegals. Nancy Pelosi, I don't know whether you saw the Wall Street Journal piece. She's pushing an agenda now that would centralize virtually voter registration out of state hands and put it in D.C. And I'm wondering to myself, that's not going to unify anybody, Scott. Call me crazy. It's not going to unify anybody.
Right. No, and I think that, as I noted in my column, the same populism that I think has infected a lot of the Republican Party is there in the Democratic Party as well. Kind of their policy prescriptions tend to be a little bit different, but at the same time, it tends to play on grievance and emotion instead of kind of cold, hard reality. And to the extent, I think the big point there is, to the extent that, as you said, that raises all sorts of issues with respect to unifying the country and partisan politics. But I mean, the other thing that's really important is that, as these policies get implemented, and as the lots of certain Americans don't actually improve, those same voters will go back and vote for even more populism and candidates that will do will promise even grander things similar in the Trump mold, I think. And so there really is, I think, a danger of indulging in the fantasy and in this kind of populist delusion about what's wrong in America, and instead of trying to implement policies that we know work pretty well, that are based on markets and science and the rest.
How much of a blunder long term, Scott, do you think that Josh Hawley and or Ted Cruz made. I mean, Scott, yeah. I'm sorry, they couldn't have thought that whole yeah. thing was going to work. Ted Cruz is smarter than that. Why did they do this?
Well, I mean, it seems that it was a pretty cynical ploy to cater to a segment of the Republican Party that is very passionate about these election issues. Of course, their passion is derived from their loyalty to the president. And so, you know, essentially they were trying to carve out a space in the post-Trump Republican Party that maintained that voter segment. And, you know, of course, the theories are that they're all angling for their own presidential run, this being Cruz and Hawley in the future. So, you know, what's the harm, right? But then we see the harm. The harm is that you lie to people long enough and they start to believe it. And the results in this particular case were, you know, a violent raid on the Capitol. But, you know, in the policy side, the results, I think, again, are less economic growth, less prosperity in the United States, and a segment of the voting population that again, becomes increasingly susceptible to kind of populist demagoguery. And that, of course, just makes our politics worse.
You center a lot at Cato. Generally, you folks there, and you particular, Scott, on markets and business around the world, globalism. The only major economy that grew last year, I read last night, was China. And then today we get this little nugget. You may have seen it off of Axios, Scott. U.S. declares China's actions against the Uyghurs a genocide. Yep. There's a nice little welcoming present for the Biden White House.
Right.
Wow. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, China is a really tough nut to crack because this is not a tiny economy. This is not, you know, some developing country that has engaged in atrocities. This is a massive economy, second largest in the world, one that has evolved over decades and has become quietly enmeshed in the global economy. And so there's no light switch you can flip. And of course, they have nuclear weapons as well. And you know, over a billion people.
Oh, by the way,
you can't just. Right. And so, you know, there's no just quick light switch solution. There's no simple fix. We're not going to just be able to slap tariffs on the Chinese. We saw that didn't work, right, on Chinese imports. And so it requires a far more strategic solution. I think, you know, one that will necessarily involve our alliances with the Europeans, with Japan, India, and others. But also, I think some really strategic thinking about both China's long-term trajectory. They have some pretty significant problems when it comes to productivity growth and demographics. They're getting very old very fast. But just as importantly, about the United States economy and what makes the United States economy so great or has in the past. And, you know, those things, whether it is freer markets and openness to trade and immigration and innovation and maintaining that kind of welcoming, opening, open and free market environment, those are the types of things that will allow us to maintain an economic counterbalance to China instead of looking inward and just getting smaller.
One final thing regarding China. Is there a fear, Scott, in the business world, in the global economy, if China, as you say, flexes its muscle and tries to move, say, militarily on Taiwan, which they've been, we see what they're doing in Hong Kong, and now you have Taiwan, and people, they're getting a little nervous. Man, that would be, I mean, what would happen? The Chinese would do it and say, yeah, so what are you going to do about it?
Right. Yeah, you know, I'll first just give the lawyerly disclaimer that, you know, foreign policy, not really my specific area of expertise. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the things that is good about having China deeply enmeshed in the global economy is that markets do punish bad behavior, mm-hmm. Whether it is global investment fleeing or whether it is, you know, all sorts of movements with currency and the rest, there would be significant pressure on the Chinese to avoid doing anything that will severely harm their own economy and And again, you know, being deeply enmeshed in the global economy makes it more difficult for them to engage in really overtly hostile reaction or hostile actions without mm-hmm. there being an adverse market reaction. So, and there's a lot of scholarly research that shows that, you know, countries tend not to go to war when they have that kind of economic engagement. So in that sense, I'm somewhat optimistic in the sense that I don't foresee there being a major military conflagration or invasion because I do think there is a significant immediate snapback that would occur in the world economy.
See, Scott, that was perfect. You said you're not a foreign policy guy. You gave me a perfect answer there. I love it. I love it.
Wrapped in economics. So I had to get back to my wheelhouse.
You played it well. He is a senior fellow of economic studies at the Cato Institute. Check him out, C-A-T-O, Cato.org. Scott's recent piece, Populist Indulgence Thwarts Serious Governing. We shall see what happens over the next 2 or 4 years. Scott Linsicum. Scott, as always, thank you, my friend. Be good. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Bye. Scott Linsicum there. Folks, check out his columns. Cato, C-A-T-O.org.
We were broadcasting from new digs. The legislature wanted their appropriations conference room back, which they had kindly lent us over the last 6 months. So, but with still the same cast of characters with Paul and Josh and Deirdre. And start off with our regular COVID update. It's been more than a few days. Relatively good news. The change since Friday, I think you can see fewer COVID cases. And for me, more importantly, the positivity rate down to 5.65%. I think that brings the 7-day average to 5.3%. And that's probably the lowest it's been, Josh tells me, since early December. So we're watching this carefully. Obviously, I'm also very happy that it's not just us. That Rhode Island and Massachusetts and even New York are trending, stabilizing or even bending the curve a little bit. And that makes an enormous difference because we got college kids coming back. A lot is going on, as you know. Current hospitalizations, 27. That's over 3 days. Our current hospitalization, 1141, that's about the same place we've been for 2 or 3 months. So, as you know, that was a key metric for me, make sure we kept capacity there, and we're maintaining capacity at our hospitals. And finally, fatalities, 6682 in total, out of 400,000 now across the United States. We hit that dismal threshold just yesterday, I think. A happier note, the vaccine update. We're still continuing to make very good progress there. Top five in the country in terms of getting those doses to work, getting you that shot in the arm. What a difference that makes. 221,000 doses administered to date. Almost all the people in the 1A group, which are those first line healthcare responders and folks in the nursing home, have gotten their first dose, and another 24,000 have gotten their second dose, and we're continuing to segue to the 75 and above population, and that's worked pretty well. We haven't opened the lens wider than that at this point, but again, we wanted to prioritize people 75 and above, and we can handle more vaccine, bring it on, but right now, what we're using the vaccine that we get from the feds in a very expedited way. That allows us to take care of the group 1A and also now some of the folks in the 75 and above. All right, you may say, why are we prioritizing the elderly? And this came up in our last meeting as well. Well, first of all, people over the age of 75 years of age are 8% of the population and 71% of the fatalities. And obviously, a lot of the folks in the emergency room, in the hospitals, and the critical care. And so it's the right thing to do. And we're continuing to prioritize folks 75 and above. We thought long and hard about who is going to be the next group that gets prioritized within this broader phase 1B. And that'll be people 65 and over. We'll get into that in a second. But folks 65 and above are 18% of the overall population, but still 88% of the fatalities. So I think you can understand why this is going to be a really important priority for us. You can see how the fatalities by age group goes down dramatically from 80 plus to 70 and above to 60 and above. So that is what's guiding us, and we'll give you some timing on that in our next chart. Phase 1A and 75 and above, that's going right now, and we're already vaccinating hundreds of people 75 and above. I think that's probably going to take us another 2 weeks or so based upon the uptake for people 75 and above. That could accelerate if we got more vaccines from the federal government. But right now, it looks like we're going to be able to open the lens and allow people 65 and above probably in a couple of weeks. We'll give you a clearer indication on that in the next 10 days. That's what our intent is going forward. Frontline essential workers will probably be at the end of February, early March. Again, that can get accelerated. If Johnson & Johnson comes online, if they free up additional doses from a Pfizer and Moderna, if they're able to start increasing manufacturing, these will all speed things up. But right now, count on somewhere around March 1 for frontline essential workers. And then phase 1C, phase 2, May would be those workers who aren't necessarily frontline, not necessarily people interfacing on a daily basis. That's in May going forward. And it's worth reminding us that, look, congregate facilities, anything from homeless shelters, addiction, correctional, it's about 50,000 doses in total. It's about 1 week. And they are being vaccinated starting very, very soon. And they're going to be done alongside the phase, the 65 and above group going forward. And I think that will make a difference in terms of their health and safety, and more broadly, to make sure that no spreads to the greater community. So our priorities, when I looked at that age and said, after 75 and above, let's go to 65 and above, is number one about saving lives and maintaining capacity in our hospitals. And it's also about ensuring equity, because we have learned the hard way that different demographic groups, different ethnic groups, blacks and other people of color, Hispanics, have been disproportionately hit. And what you look at in this chart here, these are fatalities by age group and by ethnic group. And you'll see that, African-Americans, for example, are much more likely to suffer fatality in the 70 to 79-year-old group than, say, a non-Hispanic white. And Hispanics are even more likely to suffer fatalities in that younger age group. So that's another reason why we focus on 65 and above, what a difference it makes for these populations. Paul reminds me that African-Americans are twice as likely to suffer fatality from COVID than the rest of the population. And these are all our priorities as we get this vaccination out as quickly and expeditiously as we can. So, and how are we doing that? We're doing that by launching our mass vaccination sites. This one you see in the picture from the CT Mirror, that's the Pratt runway right next to Rentschler Field. You can maybe see that in the background. As you know, at Rentschler Field, you can get a test at Rentschler Field. You get emergency food support as you need. Then you can go over right here to the Pratt facility. Thank you, Pratt, for putting this together for us. We really appreciate it. Two lines, one for the group so they can drive through and get that vaccination like you see in the other adjoining picture. And the other is so you wait 15 minutes there on site just to make sure there's no type of allergic reaction. Right now, we're getting this process going. We can handle 10 times more people there. We can handle 7 to 10,000 people at this facility if we get more vaccines. Josh tells me we've got another dozen similar mass vaccination centers in the process of opening across Connecticut over the next week or two. The mobile teams, the next group, we're taking those out to congregate facilities. We're taking those out to folks that are tougher to reach. I mean, as we found out with testing, the worried well are always ready to line up for testing. But sometimes the most effective testing are other populations that we have to bring the test to them. And in this case, we're going to bring the vaccinations to them. I think I've mentioned to you that could be some of the multifamily housing where you have multi-generations living in one place. That could be, for example, in some of the churches where we can take the parking lot and make the vaccinations available to populations that otherwise might get left behind. Community clinics, we're rolling out there. Pharmacies, we're going to have the first of the CVS and Walgreens pharmacies opening up, I think, by the end of this week. All putting in place the platform to make it easier for you to get vaccinated and to make sure we have the capacity to handle more vaccinations when the federal government is able to step things up there. And finally, we continue all of our vaccinations through the hospitals, who have been amazing partners for us throughout. Quick summary, demand is still greatly exceeding supply. That's why we have to prioritize. We're prioritizing those most at risk, those most likely to suffer the worst consequences. We've got that prioritized based on age, since that's easiest to administer and the most direct. And please be patient. I can do this now or later, but a quick update on our budget. Every quarter we give you the update, and it's good news with the caveat that things change all the time in COVID time. But right now we found our revenues are coming back stronger than we would have thought. It's not just that Melissa McCaw is a very conservative prognosticator, but who would have thought the stock market would be up 15% in 2020? But that said, nobody remembers more than we do that we're getting hit and hit hard. We'll have a small budget surplus at the end of 21, which is June 30, just like we had a surplus at the end of last fiscal year. That's great. Right now, it looks like we will not have to tap our rainy day fund, and we'll have some money to pay down some of our pension. Any questions?
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. Governor Cuomo reached out to Pfizer to try and directly deal with them to getting the vaccine. Have you had any thought of doing that, possibly doing it on a regional basis, similar to how it was an effort to grab PPE early on?
No, I haven't thought about that. I think we were smart to buy on a bulk basis going forward. Deirdre, do you want to talk about that?
I could grab that, Governor. We're in regular contact with Pfizer. Connecticut company with a large Connecticut presence here. Our understanding is that that's not going to be an option for states to direct purchase. I think the incoming Biden administration has made clear that they're going to continue to help coordinate statewide distribution of the vaccine, which we think makes a lot of sense. Keep an orderly process in place here, and we're looking forward to more support from the incoming administration to help increase the supply.
Yeah, and also in speaking to my colleague, my counterpart in New York, they received that message directly back from Pfizer as well. So while as soon as we saw that notice, we did our due diligence based upon the governor's directive. But as the governor and Josh stated, it's going to be still a federal response to this. And we're really looking forward to the new administration when they get started up around 12:05 tomorrow.
Yeah, we had states competing with each other for PPE back in the back in the spring. That was a disaster. That drove up costs and unfair distribution of the masks and gowns. This is a good way to do it. And right now, we're getting what we need on time. We could use more, but on time.
And how has the sign-up been going so far for those 75 and older? How far are hospitals being booked up? Are you hearing of issues of people struggling to sign up?
Josh, you want to take that?
Yeah, I think, I'll start and Commissioner Gifford can jump in as well. I mean, I think overall, so far, so good. We know that there are thousands of people being 75 and older being vaccinated as we speak today. you know, we have the three main channels. People are booking appointments through healthcare providers who are reaching out, some of the big hospital systems. We've got the online sign up, which you know, is available in booking sites, and then we've got the team at United Way 2-on-1 who are taking phone calls as well. And we'd like to give a particularly big shout out to the team at United Way, Lisa Tepper Bates and her team, who stood up that call center on pretty short notice. They've already handled 21,000 calls and have booked 2,400 vaccination appointments just since they went live last Thursday. So they've been doing a really incredible job. I'm really grateful for their tremendous support.
And have we received the 50,000 additional doses promised from the federal government for this week?
We're going to get them today or tomorrow. And that's going to allow us to vaccinate a lot more folks, 75 and above, a lot faster.
Thank you.
News 8.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, can you speak a little bit more specifically regarding the TARA approach and with well over 1 million people eligible in 1B, was that the best approach going forward to take that tier effect?
I think was the best approach. I'll tell you, 75 and above, easy to administer. We're getting those vaccinations out quickly and frankly, a very high take-up rate. 65 and above will be very similar, quickly to administer, easy to identify who those people are. High uptake in terms of people who want to get it. I think it made a fair amount of sense. My instinct is after the 65 and above, you're going to move more broadly to essential workers, less about by age group. I think that's the right way to go.
Obviously, with so many moving parts to this, it gets very involved. And there was some confusion with teachers who were not supposed to be eligible, but a school system or two sent all their names in. What has been done to try and rectify that from happening again?
By telling people that respect the process. These are the phase 1A people. This is the priorities for phase 1B. Look, that said, we give a lot of doses out to the schools. They're prioritizing school nurses. If there's some doses left over, they provide that to make sure nothing goes to waste. It's not the way to go. We want to be strict about this, but we also want to make sure the vaccines get administered.